First thing I would like to do in lab this afternoon is to just make some final comments on lab exercise or lab report number 2. And that is the heat of vaporization lab. So if you haven't seen it yet, the data have been released. It was data provided by Professor Muzzi, and because she had already put it in a format, I just left it as it is, since I gave her credit for generating it. Yes, technically, I guess you could just include it. I'd have to look more closely to make sure, but I would like you to put it into your own format somehow. And so your report is going to be much like what you had last time. You're going to include that data in one way or another. We have the various calculations that we went over in class. Yes, including the appropriate graph, which would be natural log of pressure versus 1 over temperature. I will look up the appropriate value. I spaced and totally forgot to do it between the classes this afternoon to look up the one I want everybody to use. So I will look that up. It's not due for a week, though, so we got time. But yes, I would like you to calculate percent error. And so that means, just like last time, you don't need any purpose. Don't need any specific conclusion statement. And there's no real discussion either. Now, some of you had to resubmit your first reports, and so I will be getting to those right away to make sure you have your comments back in order to be able to start working on your second lab report. One thing that I did not comment on previously, and that's because I was waiting to see everybody's reports first, is this: for this second round, I would ask that your report cannot just be a spreadsheet alone. Because what some of you did is you used Excel or some other app, and you created a spreadsheet where you had the tables just like what I wanted. You had the prototype and substituted calculation, so you did everything by the book, you could say. But if you step back and look at it as a document, it's not in the format that you would normally present that kind of report in. So yes, you completed the assignment. No, you didn't get any points off for doing it that way, but I am requesting that you not do it this time around. So when you create a table or a graph or something, you need to go ahead and just put that into some kind of word processing document, whether you use Google Docs or Word or Word, it still exists, Word Perfect, whatever platform you use. Make it more like a report presentation, not just a spreadsheet. Does anyone have any clarifications about what you need to do for your second experiment?
Professor, I had a question.
Sure.
So when you say it can't be a spreadsheet, you just mean like make it look presentable?
You know, you can make spreadsheets look like word processing documents. And so if you do that, you're satisfying the spirit of it. But in most businesses, you'd probably be expected to come up with a Word or Doc or Google Doc or some format that's more interchangeable, more common for doing reports. So you might use an Excel or some other spreadsheet to generate your tables. I do that myself because the tools in a spreadsheet are a lot more designed, a lot more powerful than in a word processing program. But then you can take that table as is and plop it in the middle of a word processing program to then format it with some page layout.
Okay, makes sense.
So that's what I'm trying to get at. Not that it has to look as beautiful as something like, if you want to call my syllabus beautiful, my syllabus is heavily formatted, is what you could say. And it doesn't have to be anything that well formatted. But that's why I'm making small suggestions over time to guide you all to what a normal report would look like. Some instructors just flat out wouldn't take a spreadsheet, period. Let's see, where can we find the example? Oh, and I was so tied up with other things over the weekend, I literally forgot. It wasn't that I was just lazy and I'll get to that later. No, I just literally forgot that I had come up with that example lab report. So I need to go back and finish that up and post it. So I will get that up hopefully today, but more likely tomorrow morning, but it'll be soon because it was almost done. Just literally forgot about it. So that'll help you all out too. And what I'll do is I'll just put that on the Canvas website so you have an easy way of getting to it.
Professor, I have one more question.
Sure.
So it's not about the lab, but okay. I think you made an announcement a few minutes ago that lab's not going to be held for next quarter.
I didn't say that yet. I said that most instruction is going to be online, but if you read the full, and because this is going to be part of the recording, I'm not reading anything that was said to be kept private. So this was an announcement that went out from the president of the college, and it says, "Dear colleagues, thank you to our faculty and classified professional for participating last week in the surveys about fall quarter. As you know, we must plan for fall knowing that public health issues are paramount and may continue to evolve. For these reasons, and based on responses to the faculty survey, fall quarter will be taught mostly online. Some classes will be held in hybrid format, and active Vice President of Instruction Lori Rank and the acting president Christina Espinosa-Peeb will be working with faculty and deans to finalize which classes those will be. I know they're meeting with chemistry and biology faculty. I know nothing more than that, and that's not me hiding anything. We haven't met with her yet, so we don't know."
This is that email or that message you just read is strictly for fall, right?
Yep.
I think summer's going to be
completely summer's online. Totally online. And with the possible exception of one or two classes that may do a trial of a home lab kit, and this is all still being discussed, there is going to be no on-campus lab in the summer.
Nice. Wish we did have lab, though, to be honest.
I really would like to be out of my comfortable box.
Me too.
Yeah.
But, you know, I read something today, and maybe I'll go ahead and share this in the recording just for posterity's sake. And this is nothing I've had to experience in my lifetime, so that's why I really had to think of it. Does anybody know who George Takei is?
Is that a... Oh my gosh, he's the driver in Star Trek, right?
Sulu, yes.
Sulu, yeah.
Oh yeah. So, and yes, exactly. And he has been a political voice in his later life, because if you don't know some of his story, he did grow up in one of the internment camps during World War II because he was Japanese descent. So, you know, put in prison essentially for who he was during wartime setting. And he made a comment, I don't know when it was, he said, essentially, I don't want to misquote it. Hold on, let me pull up so I don't misquote him. And I haven't fact-checked to make sure this is true, but this sounds so much like him, I wouldn't bother to make sure it's true. He said, "I didn't spend my childhood in barbed wire enclosement internment camps so I could listen to grown-up adults today cry oppression because they have to wear a mask at Costco." So, yeah. So, you know, I don't know what's going to happen in the fall, but I don't want to catch it, not because of my own self, because of the elderly or sick people I could pass it to. So it's not so much about me, even. It's like, let them have the freedom to live. If you want to talk about freedom a little bit. But now I'm starting to digress. So... Now, back to the chemistry. I think that ends up for the questions for experiment two, doesn't it? All right. Well, then, your instructor is going to try to recover from the disastrous lab lecture he had this morning, because whatever series of brain cells normally let me kind of talk and create on the fly oh, it was not working so well this morning. And maybe because I myself had somehow lost the big picture of what's going on in the experiment. So let me just remind you that there are four things that we're analyzing for. There's potassium, there's iron, there's oxalate, and there's the fact that this salt, the green salt, is a hydrate. So what did I just say? There's potassium, iron, oxalate, and it's a hydrate. And so your experimental procedure is divided up into different portions, and some of it's done by days, and some of it's done by parts. So the parts are the logical different parts of the experiment that happen to be done on different days in real life. So we did parts 1, 2, and 3 in our discussion before, because part 1 was just the synthesis, part 2 was the purification, the recrystallization that we had discussed, and then part 3 was the analysis of the oxalate by redox titration. So what we're supposed to be talking about today now is part 4, which is the analysis of iron 3. Okay, and let me back up here as well and give you a little context, and this is going to help with trying to wade through this section. The iron in the green salt, in that formula that I've written there, it's tied up with oxalate at the moment, water's attached to it as a hydrate, potassium is there as a counter ion. But the iron could always react with something else. It's possible for that oxalate to be pushed out, especially if we were to mess with the oxidation state of iron. So there's going to be two things that happen in order to try to analyze the iron. We're going to reduce the iron from iron 3 to iron 2. And you might say, why? And the answer a little bit is because. Because if we then add another reagent in, it forms a new complex, separate from the green salt. Oxalate and water are gotten rid of. You have this new complex that contains just the iron from the original salt. So that's how you're able to analyze for the iron, because essentially you're going to react it out of the green salt and capture it in something else. So I think the big mistake I made this morning is I didn't put any of what I just said in print form. So, the iron 3 from the green salt is going to be captured in a new separate complex. So that the iron 3 can be separately analyzed. So the first substance that you encounter in the lab in terms of reaction involves the substance hydroxylamine. So an amine is a functional group, this NH2 group that's attached. That's the same amine like amino, as in amino acids. So amino acids have these NH2 groups on them as well. The hydroxyl, that's another name for alcohol. Why is it hydroxyl instead of alcohol? Because, right. So anyways, it is a common substance in organic land. And what happens is that you can react this with HCl. Why? Well, because an amine is a Brunsted-Lowry base. Remember, an Arrhenius base is something that has to have hydroxide as part of its structure. And that's founded on the definition of water. But a Bruce-Lowry base just has to be something that reacts with H+. Now, maybe you haven't seen this notation before, but it's a way of showing how electrons can move in a chemical reaction. And so, in this case, the nitrogen from the amine group grabs another proton and becomes positively charged. And then there's going to be chloride that's still floating around as a counter-ion, something that balances out the charge of the nitrogen. And so you put it together, and that turns into the compound hydroxylamine hydrochloride. Now, take your screenshots because I have story time. Okay, so as an example, and you wouldn't be familiar with this compound necessarily, there is an organic compound known as aniline. But there's a substance that is called aniline hydrogen chloride. And here is how the formula for that substance could be written out. C6H5NH2.HCl. I had to think for a moment because I can't think organic compounds outside of line structures. So here's the line structure that would correspond to that compound. So let me just count. 6 carbons, 5 hydrogens, 2 more. Yes, that's right. Wait, what's that .HCl about? It's kind of like what we use for hydrates and water. So I see someone asking, is that a hydrate that soaks up HCl? It's not a hydrate because it's not water, but it is a complex. And where you might see this is in your medications. Like, you might take some kind of medications and it says blah, 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 thiazide, .HCl. What does that .HCl mean? It's been reacted with hydrogen chloride to make a salt. Why would we do that? What if it's a medication that is more easily ingested in aqueous form? And salts are water soluble. Neutral amines might not be. They might be organic soluble, fat soluble. That might be something, though, that you'd have to inject in order for it to be more easily absorbed. So if you're taking a pill that's going to go into your pH 1 or 2 stomach environment anyways and get acidified anyways, why not make it easier to put it into water in the first place and make it a salt and make it the hydrogen chloride complex? Now, when there's more time, because I know I'll get the eyebrow from a couple of people, this is not unconnected to something known as freebasing, but that's a whole nother lecture. Anyways. So, now, where were we before I said all that? Oh, yes! What's going to happen with this iron 3? So, not writing it in proper reaction format, just in conceptual format. What's going to happen is the iron 3 is going to react with this hydroxylamine hydrogen chloride. It's sad when you can write chemistry faster than your native language. But there's another story related to that another time. So this reduces it to iron 2, which, so what? Well, then it reacts with this organic substance known as orthophenanthraline. So let me try to write that substance structure carefully here. I'm going to write it differently than I did this morning because it always confuses me to write it the way it's in the textbook. So this, of course, is written in line structure format because it's cruelty to the instructor to insist that I write this out in normal format because it's just, it's a mess. So the point is, this is a kind of ligand. It's an organic molecule that is able to have the lone pairs of those nitrogens attached to the iron tube. And it turns out that three of these orthophenanthrenes react with one of these iron 2 ions to form a complex. The complex, to write it more simply, I'm going to abbreviate. So phen means phenanthrene. There's three of them. They're neutral, so they don't affect the charge of the iron itself. And so this whole complex ends up as a plus 2 charge. So this is another complex ion that apparently is orange in color, which is why I'm writing it orange. And the name of this is ferroin. The ferroin ion. There must be some practical application to this that I'm just forgetting from my own chemistry background. Like, don't you remember the ferroin experiment? It feels like something like that. But the fer in the ferroin name comes from iron. And then the phen, the O-N, that's a common naming for a lot of organic substances. Are we supposed to write this down? Well, you do have it in the notes you can download once they're posted. Am I going to ask you for the structure in a quiz? Probably not, because you would all just look at the notes and then curse my name as you're forced to write all the little double and single lines. But yeah, in real life, you write down the things the instructor are writing. Okay, so let me try to relate this back to the point again, if I can flip back to the previous page momentarily. So we are supposed to be determining how much iron is present in the green salt. The way we isolate the iron from the green salt is to reduce it and then to complex it with a different ligand to make a new complex. And then spectroscopy happens. And this happens exactly the way that I described in the spectroscopy lab lecture, which is that you have some kind of light source that in real life has a knob where you can adjust which wavelength of light that you're using. You pass that through a sample that is in a fancy test tube called a cuvette. What's the difference between a test tube and a cuvette? Several dollars. That's not the flippant answer. That's the real answer. That a cuvette is made with much more precision than a test tube would be made with. And I know the iPad froze. Give me a moment. There we go. So cuvettes, instead of being 1 centimeter in width, they might be 1.000 centimeters in width, so that there's a heck of a lot more precision. They might, for example, be made out of quartz instead of normal glass, so that the quartz interferes less with the light that's passing through it. That's what a cuvette is. That's your sample. Then that hits some kind of detector. Now, in this experiment, what I'm about to describe has already been done for you. But if we were dealing with a new substance, if we wanted to understand how to analyze that substance, we would first want to find where is it sensitive to light. So in this kind of experiment, what you would do. Where'd it go? There we go. Is we'd start at one end of the visible spectrum and to overly round the numbers. Let's call it 400 for the low end wavelength. Low number wavelength, I should say. And then up to 700 at the other end. So if you had an ideal substance, you might generate a curve that looks something like this. Here, let me try that again. I'm talking really ideal. A nice narrow peak, it's called, that is centered around one wavelength. Real spectrum might be more spread out than this. Now, why might that be? So sometimes solutions, just the interactions of things in solutions, can affect the way that absorbance might occur in a complex. So in a complex, you might have a specific wavelength that it's supposed to absorb. But because the metal involved might have some solvent around it, maybe that somehow slightly changes the wavelength that it'll absorb at. The reason I'm saying in all this is that you might remember that in spectroscopy in general, when you pass different wavelengths through a sample, the ones that match energy gaps in that sample are the ones that are going to be absorbed. And in something like atomic spectra, those are very sharp lines, you might remember. But in molecules, and especially in solution like this, it's not always as sharp. You get this broadening that can occur. But this analysis, like I said, had already been done for this Ferroin complex, so you didn't have to do it. Now, let me put in my axes here, because I wrote it, but didn't put the unit in. It's wavelength for the x-axis, and it's going to be A for absorbance on the y-axis. So absorbance is exactly what it sounds like, how much light gets absorbed at a particular wavelength. And maybe remember even that during the spectroscopy lecture, I had described this as lambda max, the wavelength of maximum absorbance, where you get the maximum response out of the sample, which let me try to make that more actually on the peak there. There we go. And because this is a well-studied compound, it's known that the lambda max happens to be at 5-10 nanometers. Okay, so why does that matter? Well, what if you happen to have other substances in the solution? Like I said, the iron does make a complex, but what if there's oxalate or something else in solution that maybe absorbs at a different wavelength? Well, if we know that Ferroin complex reliably absorbs at 5-10, that's where we're going to scan for it. To put it in another perspective, if you scan, like even if there were no other substances in the solution, why would you scan for the substance somewhere where it doesn't respond? Like why would you measure it at 400 or at 700 if you're not really going to get any response? You'd logically measure the substance where it responds the most, at this lambda max. So this absorbance graph shows that the complex formed by iron 2 and phenanthrene is most sensitive at the wavelength 510 nanometers. This is therefore the wavelength that should be used to analyze the compound. Sorry. You know, random detail. The room I'm in actually was constructed with a dry board that has a mild form of audio dampening in it so that I could do things like recording in here. But I didn't do it quite right because the real way, the expensive way, is to do what's called double framing, where you have a frame on the inside that is loosely connected to the frame on the outside. So if you get this low rumbling like my neighbor riding his motorcycle, it shakes the outside but not the inside. It's awesome, but it's expensive. Anyways, screenshots before we go to the next slide. Okay, so what is this analysis that we're supposed to be doing? Okay, so let me give it the context again. We're supposed to be looking for iron because it's part of the green salt. And I said, let's make a new complex that would trap the iron out. Okay, so we've got this new complex. And why are we sniffing it out at this one wavelength of light? Because it turns out that there is a correlation between absorbance and concentration. And it is the very popularly named Beer's Law. So Beer's Law has this format. And I usually write the variables in a different order. But there's a reason I want to do it this way. You see, it's a very simple relationship where A is absorbance. L is what? That is path length. In other words, how far does light pass through the sample? Why might that affect its absorbance? Okay, so if you're a geek and a kid and OCD like me, all rolled into one, then you might have noticed at some point that if you take a uneven shaped container like an Erlenmeyer flask or something like that, something with a narrow neck up top and a round flask at the bottom. If you put food coloring, especially the blue kind, and put a few drops in there, if you look through the narrow part of the tube, you're going to see something that looks more like a blue color. But if you look through the larger base, it's going to look more purple. It's the same food coloring. So no, it's not two different colors, but it's two different absorbances because more light obviously passes through the thicker part of the glassware. So that's what path length is, and that's why it matters, and that's why we use cuvettes that are very precisely made, so we have a very precise path length. C is for cookie, and that's good enough for me. Now, C is, of course, concentration. And it's this last one that gets people, this extinction coefficient. Which sounds like something a dinosaur should have. Except extinction in this case means the extinction of light. In other words, that you're diminishing the amount of light that's present. So the extinction coefficient tells you how sensitive a substance is to a particular wavelength, or therefore frequency, of light. It's our fudge factor. It's what makes this proportionality statement true. And what's the point? Well, I said it before, but I'll repeat it. We already know this complex well, this new one we're trying to make. So we already know the extinction coefficient. It's been measured and we're given it. Or, I think in the directions it says, the instructor will come up with a calibration curve. Well, it's been done. So we have what that epsilon is. And then path length, that's fixed by the cubet, and it's 1 centimeter. 1, in other words. 1.000. So that means as long as we can measure the absorbance, we can easily calculate the concentration of iron present. If we know the concentration of iron, and we could project to how much total solution there would be, like the way we made the sample, then we can figure out the total moles of iron involved, which from moles we can get to mass, and from mass we can get to mass percent. In other words, we can analyze for how much iron is present. So what was that last statement I made? It was, since the ferroin complex is well studied, then we'll warm it up with a glow of chemistry. Oh, come on. There we go. Since the ferroin complex is well studied, and what does that mean? Meaning epsilon is known. And since a cuvette with a fixed path length is used, the concentration of ferroin can be determined by measuring the absorbance. From this concentration, many steps later, the amount of iron in the green salt can be determined. This next part of the experiment is going to be a lot more familiar to all because it is a hydrate analysis. Now, I know I'm going to use this term right away, so let me just jump in and define this. Hygroscopic. And no, I didn't write a G by mistake. It is hygro with a G, because there's already another piece of instrumentation called a hydroscope. And so there's a separate term to keep from confusion. Hygroscopic means a substance that can spontaneously absorb water. And we're going to talk more about this spontaneous term soon. But for right now, the reason I mentioned the term hygroscopic is we have to do this process known as heating to constant mass. And why is that? Glassware, whether it's glass or some other material, is generally hygroscopic. Hygroscopic. So in order to ensure that the mass of the water that's in the glassware itself doesn't mess with our measurement of the hydrate somehow, we have to fully heat up that glassware first. So glassware is hygroscopic, so the glassware must be heated to drive off any water. Before it is used, so it does not interfere with measuring the hydrate. So I'll describe that process on the next page, but go ahead and get your screenshots first. Okay. Then here is the process of heating to constant mass. When we start the heating process, we don't really need to measure the mass of the empty glassware because we're just going to assume off the bat that it's got water in it. So no need, therefore, to measure it. So we'll say that here is the empty glassware. And then we heat it. And I'm going to leave the details of how we heat it out at the moment because we need to review the procedure one day anyways when we're going over the calculations. I've just put in parentheses here, heat, just in case you're not familiar with this symbol, the triangle, that is universally recognized in chemistry as meaning heat. So then we get our flask or our container after the first time it's heated, and that's where we would take our first mass measurement. So we call that mass number one. Then, how do we know we drove off all the water? You might say, well, it's going to weigh less than it did before or have less mass than it did before. Yes, but do we know how much less mass it's supposed to have? No. And so we have to at least heat it one more time and then get a second mass measurement. So if the glassware is heated appropriately, all the water should have been driven away after the first heating. Which means what? It means mass measurements number one and two should be the same. those should be the same within a reasonable degree. What does that mean? Well, if glassware is hygroscopic, that technically means as soon as you're done with the heating process, it can turn around and start absorbing water again. So, if you waited too long to take the mass measurement, then the mass is going to be too high. Of course, if you try to put the glassware into the balance right away, you're going to get an incorrect measurement possibly then, too. And not because you may somehow damage the balance, not because of it being hot, although that's not such a swift idea also. But no, the main problem is there's a lift current that gets generated. That hot air is rising on the inside there, and once you get down to the level of precision that our balances do, which is the decimilligram level, 0.0001 grams or 0.1 milligrams, that's darn sensitive. So air currents or things like that can disturb a measurement. So there is a solution that I'll tell you in a moment that we can get around this problem somewhat. But that's why I say that the mass measurements 1 and 2 should be the same to each other within reason. And the way that the lab procedure is usually written is that within reason is within 1 milligram. Oh, dear. Oh, I'm seeing the chat window. Yeah, being in one place for this long, it does have its effects. Not that everybody has the means or the location to do so, but if you can just get out in nature somehow, that sure helps a heck of a lot. If you're like me and fortunate enough to live in a place where you have a yard, a little bit of gardening helps too. Just a friendly suggestion from someone also trapped on the inside. Okay. So if the measurements are not the same, because maybe you didn't heat it enough the first time, if the measurements are not the same, the process is repeated until they are. And for the chat window, since I think you'll understand this, and now for something completely different. Okay. So I was mentioning earlier that there's a way to help this process along, you know, this balance of not doing it so quick that you get the lift effect, but not waiting so long. So the optional part that we don't do in our lab procedure anymore is to put the whole thing in something known as a desiccator. Which, this is a very rough version of what one of these would look like. So there's a chamber in the bottom part that you fill with what's known as a desiccant. And this thing, it would be the desiccator, which these are just fancy words for meaning drying. So down below here, I'll define desiccant. That is a substance that is, well, in fact, the literal translation would be drying agent. So that is a substance that is so hygroscopic it is used to remove water from other substances. So just like sometimes when you order electronics, maybe when you order certain types of food, you get it and there's a little package, you know, either in paper, a little plastic container. It says do not eat, which instantly makes you want to say, why not? What's in it? And it's a desiccant is what's in it. It's a drying agent. It's to keep the electronics or food dry. So a desiccator is just the larger version of that. And let me write that word desiccator in a different color so you know that that is referring to this glassware here. Okay, so we got desiccant, and then let's get desiccator. That's a chamber containing a desiccant used to keep glassware or reagents free of water. So, no, to wrap it up for the lab, let me do that on the next page. So, please get your screenshots. To analyze the green salt, we would do this process of constant mass. The glassware would first be heated to constant mass. Then a sample of the green salt would be measured without heating, just the green salt itself. Then the salt would be heated to constant mass. The difference in the mass before and after heating the salt is the mass of water in the green salt hydrate.